Do we finally know that statins are good for you?
Evaluating treatment for localized prostate cancer.
What about that difference in heart attacks between men and women?
And should we be using routine screening tests for ovarian cancer?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on September 16th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we're going to have to turn to The Lancet right away. That's a look at, I suggested, the statins. Are they really good for you? Gosh, this ongoing debate. And hopefully this is approaching the last word anyway.
Well, you're right, Elizabeth. This should be the last word, at least for a while. This is one of the most comprehensive studies that I've ever seen, and it was done to help inform the public about decisions about whether this should be on statin therapy for the prevention of heart attacks and strokes. Because although they've been shown to be effective, there has been some concerns about some of the safety or adverse effects. And as a result, millions of people that should be on a statin and can benefit from it probably aren't taking it because of undue concern. So let's get into specifics. They looked at all the randomized control trials to look at the risk-benefit ratio of statin use. There's a tremendous amount of evidence, what's called large-scale evidence from randomized trials, showing that statin therapy reduces the risk of major vascular events, deaths from heart disease, heart attacks, strokes, even needing bypass surgery or stents by about 25% for every 30 milligram per deciliter reduction in LDL cholesterol. That absolute benefit varies depending upon the patient's risk. The higher your risk, the more benefit. What they showed is if you use a low-cost statin and treat 10,000 individuals for 5 years, they typically would prevent a major vascular event in 1,000 patients that already have known disease, that's called secondary prevention, and in 500 patients without known disease, that's primary prevention. So of 10,000 patients, 1,500 would avoid having a vascular event like a heart attack or stroke or death. Conversely, what are the side effects? Well, severe muscle injury called rhabdomyolysis. That would occur in about 5 cases of those 10,000 patients treated for 5 years. It's also associated with an increased incidence of diabetes. That would be 50 to 100 new cases of diabetes and about 5 to 10 hemorrhagic strokes. So what you can see is that the benefit clearly outweighs the risk, certainly in people that have known vascular disease and those that are at high risk.
Rick, how do you account for the fact that so many people who might benefit from statins are resistant to using them?
I think there's been an underestimation of the benefits and an over-exaggeration of the harms.
So what do you tell people right now when you're talking to them about your advice with regard to going on a statin or continuing on a statin?
I think these numbers are pretty solid. I think you can tell them that there's a 10 to 15% reduction in major vascular events and a less than 1% risk of having a major side effect. So certainly in people that have known disease or at high risk, there's no question that statin therapy, the benefits outweigh the risk.
Since we're talking about the heart then, let's move right to JAMA Internal Medicine, something that's been inexplicable for a really long time, lots of theories relative to it. Hey, what about this lifetime risk of having a myocardial infarction or a heart attack between men and women?
Cardiovascular disease was often thought to be a disease primarily of men, but we now know it's a recognized number one killer in women as well. Despite the fact that women have a lower incidence of heart disease when they're young and middle-aged. Now, a lot of this was thought to be due to risk factors, and that men have more risk factors for heart disease, things like high cholesterol or smoking or high blood pressure. But what this study attempted to do was to adjust for those risks and say, is it just risk factors or is it really a gender difference? So to do that, they looked at a population-based prospective study from Norway of almost 34,000 individuals, half of whom were women. Now, these individuals range from 35 to 102 years of age, and they had an almost 18-year follow-up. And they looked at the incidence rate for heart attacks. They looked at the differences in sex or gender, age, birth cohort, cholesterol, blood pressure, lifestyle factors, diabetes, known risk factors. And here's what they discovered. Even adjusting for all the other risk factors or matching individuals, men have a twofold higher risk of having heart attack. That risk remains up until about age 95. Now, it narrows somewhat, but clearly there's a gender gap aside from the known cardiovascular risk factors.
I thought one thing that was really interesting about this particular study was that in the past we've speculated that there's been a protective role for estrogen. And we know that in women, the heart disease precipitously increases postmenopausally. I'm not sure. What do you think about what this study informs us with regard to that?
Well, if you thought it was all due to menopause, then as soon as women became postmenopausal, the risk would be the same as men or higher. But as this study shows, there's a gap that persists. It narrows somewhat, but it persists all the way up through age 95.
So it's really interesting because to me, it calls into question, well, what is the mechanism?
And that's a great question. This doesn't address that. It does clearly show, though, that it's not due to known cardiovascular risk factors. So there's something other than what we currently know that accounts for this.
Okay. Since we're talking about men and their health woes, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. Two studies, big studies, taking a look at outcomes relative to different strategies, different interventions for management of low-risk prostate cancer.
Now, when we say low-risk prostate cancer, we're talking primarily about localized prostate cancer. And the big conundrum is, if it is localized, how do you treat that? The three current modalities are watchful waiting, continue to follow the PSA to see if it rises. Second is, some men are advised to get radiotherapy. Or the third is to have a prostatectomy, that is to remove the prostate. What this study did was looked at 1,643 men who had localized prostate cancer. They agreed to be randomized to either monitoring, surgery, or radiotherapy and followed for 10 years. These two studies examine what the survival was and also what the side effects for each of the therapies was. At a meeting of 10 years, the prostate cancer-specific mortality, that is dying from prostate cancer, was low irrespective of which treatment the men received, and there was no significant difference among the treatments. It was noted, however, that surgery and radiotherapy had lower incidences of disease progression and metastasis than active monitoring, but no change in mortality. However, when one looks at the side effects, there were significantly more side effects associated with prostate surgery or radiotherapy. Prostatectomy had the greatest negative effect on sexual function and urinary continence. Radiotherapy had the greatest effect on things like bowel function and trouble with urination, either voiding or nocturia. Those got better over the course of a year, but nevertheless, fewer side effects reported with monitoring.
I found something really fascinating about the press coverage of these studies, or this particular study that you've talked about, because I want to talk also about the patient satisfaction and self-reportage of side effects. It was interesting to see how different outlets framed this up. For example, this morning, the New England Journal of Medicine, the Physician's First Watch, said higher rate of metastasis with active surveillance. So clearly their slant was, hey, if you choose active surveillance, you're risking higher rate of metastasis, which is true. But the flip side is that, as you've already identified, and I think I saw in the New York Times this morning, there's no difference in survival. So that's the hard outcome. So it's weighing a plethora of potential side effects against survival.
Absolutely. And I think that's why this study is particularly good. It evaluates 10-year survival, not only cancer-related, but overall survival to show that all three therapies have the same outcome. But they also talk about the side effects over the course of 10 years. And this kind of knowledge allows the person to be involved in the decision about which of the three therapies do they want. If they're concerned about metastasis and not worried about sexual function or continence or bowel or bladder function, then a more aggressive therapy might be chosen. However, if you say, listen, my survival is going to be the same and I don't want to have any of those side effects, then monitoring is the most appropriate therapy.
Let's move then to the other study that's also in the New England Journal of Medicine that talked about patient outcomes, patient-reported outcomes.
This was interesting because with all three therapies, there were no significant differences observed in measures of things like anxiety or depression or what the individuals considered quality of life.
Okay, so finally then, let us turn to the FDA. The agency has issued a warning to women who are concerned about ovarian cancer. Hey, folks, these tests don't work.
So the concern relates to the fact that ovarian cancer is the fifth leading cause of cancer-related death among women. So a lot of individuals have been interested in developing screening tests like we have for colon cancer or breast cancer with mammography. What the FDA warns in a very strongly worded note is that there are no screening tests for ovarian cancer that are sensitive enough to reliably screen for ovarian cancer without a high number of inaccurate results. There's been some recent companies that have marketed tests claiming that it can be an accurate way to screen or exclude ovarian cancer. What the FDA is saying is that is totally false.
Caveat emptor. It's such a shame, isn't it? Because so much of this is predatory when these things are put out there and marketed directly to consumers.
It is. And what many consumers don't realize is ovarian cancers really don't have a precancer that you can identify beforehand unless you do invasive surgery. And furthermore, ovarian cancer usually spreads to other parts of the abdominal cavity before it's discovered. We've not been successful in identifying accurate screening tests for ovarian cancer, and the FDA wants the public to be aware of that.
So, back to the drawing board. On that note then, I think I'm going to talk about the prostate cancer studies in the New England Journal of Medicine this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.